Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Elfson with the Digital Education Podcast. Another opportunity for me to talk with interesting people in the education space. And I find them all over the place. And I think if you've listened before, I had a conversation with Corey DeAngelis back this summer on how Horace Mann had it all wrong, which I loved it, and which I've gotten to know Corey primarily through Twitter. And so it's a pretty cool world. Corey is a policy analyst at the Cato Center, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. And Corey, I'm just going to jump right into it because, you know, even on Twitter the last couple of days, you reposted your dissertation called Societal Impacts of Private School Choice Around the World. And then there was, you know, kind of some exciting news for you, I think, personally, that Social Science Quarterly accepted, you know, some research from you on your on the Milwaukee schools research that you did. Can you give me, just as we start, just a basic background of some of that research and some of what you're learning, and even why, as an educational researcher, getting something in Social Science Quarterly is such a big deal?
Yeah, of course. Thanks. I'm glad you saw the retweet of the dissertation. It's 120 pages. I don't expect people to go and read that, but I have op-eds on all three of the chapters. But essentially, what I wanted to look at was the non-test score impacts of school choice or private schooling all around the world. And primarily, the dissertation focused on effects on criminal activity and effects on non-cognitive skills of students. So whether they work hard on standardized tests instead of just looking at their raw test scores. And what we found, you know, in those studies was primarily that, one, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program greatly reduced the likelihood that students grew up to become criminals. In particular, they were about half as likely to commit misdemeanors and felonies by the time they were 22 to 25 years old. And also we used international PISA data, the international test score data, and looked at student level data and found that the students that went to private schools, even after controlling for their background, of, you know, their family characteristics, their family's income, their racial background, a whole slew of characteristics, and using a rigorous technique called instrumental variables, found that students that got the chance to go to private school worked harder. And so that's a really important finding. That was the first study to look at that. The crime study was the first study to look at crime. I will say the crime study was my first paper at Arkansas, the first paper I ever started at the Department of Education Reform. And it's now my 14th publication in Social Science Quarterly, so I was really excited about that. It's a very controversial paper because, again, it's the first paper linking a voucher program to adult criminal activity. And it's the only study that looks at that. And it also finds that school choice reduces crime. So you can kind of see how that's a really politically charged topic right now, especially with Betsy DeVos. And, you know, I had a lot of trouble going through the education peer review process. But it's finally, you know, accepted at Social Science Quarterly. So I'm really excited about that. My co-author, Patrick Wolf at the University of Arkansas, is really excited about that. Because, again, we had a lot of ideological rejections in the first six journals that we, submitted it to. So it's finally found a home in Social Science Quarterly, our seventh journal we submitted it to.
Why do you think, you know, maybe before we get into, because really the reason why I want to talk to you is kind of some of the post-election stuff. Why do you think, you know, just even some research that would add to the conversation, move it along a little bit more, why is it consistently in kind of the education world and in the research world difficult to get a home for some of these places when, you know, the research has been vetted, when there's an opportunity, and when it leads to more interesting conversation and questions about what we're doing and how we can do it better?
Well, it's pretty unfortunate in the education sector that there's just a lot of political bias, even though, you know, academia is supposed to be just about finding truth. It should just be based on the methods. But just looking at some of our reviews, there were reviews that explicitly said, I believe this is a causal paper. I believe that this is, you know, the methods are legit, so you guys are being good scientists. But on the other hand, the reviewer said, well, this is, you know, I don't like the narrative that this is painting. So this is, you know, it's an unfortunate truth that the academy is, especially in the education sector, is highly biased against conservative or even libertarian type of policies, because I think the reviewers know that, you know, this information is being used, the academic articles and the results are being used to sway public policy. And, you know, the reviewers are blind. So what that means is that, you know, when I submit the crime paper to a specific journal, it goes out to a reviewer or, you know, two or three reviewers that are also academics who are probably left-leaning, because that's what the education sector is comprised of. And I don't know who that reviewer is, and I cannot hold them accountable for unfair reviews. So we get the reviews back and we get, you know, we can see what they said, but I can never post that online and tie it to a specific individual. So I think the blindness of the peer review process kind of makes that a much bigger and more difficult problem. And, you know, the editors can look at those reviews and send it to a new reviewer if they think that those reviews are unfair. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen all that often. You know, editors are very busy people. So, you know, rationally, they rely on the reviewers to make good decisions. And they kind of just rely on those reviews to make, you know, their top level decisions. And to be clear, the reviewers can always kind of make up reasons for rejecting certain results that they don't like. For example, the crime study was quasi-experimental. It's not a true random assignment study, and that, you know, it's really hard to get random assignment data, but it is the best matching procedure that you can use in social science to try to replicate a true random assignment experiment. And so, you know, the reviewers a lot of the times would attack the methods and say, you know, this isn't a true experiment, you didn't use lottery data. But then if you go and look at the top education journals, they also, they will publish results that are non-experimental and purely correlational. So it seems like the same standard isn't being applied across different types of results. And it's hard to, you know, say that with certainty, but it seems that seems to be like what's going on in the education sector. And Jay Green has written a lot on this at the University of Arkansas. So if you want to read more about political bias in the education sector, I direct you to the JP Green blog.
No, I appreciate that, Corey, because I think sometimes, you know, even, you know, I've kind of been in and out of that academic space and that research space. And it is always that interesting conversation because, you know, even when I was in Boston and going through, you know, my academic work and just some of the other things, is you do have this conversation about, hey, we're seeking truth and we're seeking opportunity and we want to understand better and you want to create high quality, you know, research or gain better understandings. But then when somebody does and the findings aren't what, you know, what they don't like, then it kind of gets, you know, placed outside of the system and to be able to have that impact. But not to go too far in depth there, because that's not the reason why I wanted to talk to you today. But, it, you know, really in conversation, I'm really interested as we kind of finish out 2018 and we head into a new year in 2019, and you know, we'll have kind of a new setup in Congress with, you know, Democrats in charge of the House, you know, Republicans in the Senate, you know, obviously the presidential situation. You have some shifting at some of the state levels with governors and mm-hmm. legislators. And it's just, and then even the conversation of whether, you know, Secretary DeVos will stay on or whether she'll kind of, you know, move on, you know, here after, you know, after the new year into 2019. So as you look back at this election, you know, that happened a couple weeks ago, and then as we look forward to 2019, what are you seeing? What are you keeping track of? What kind of, you know, are you interested in this space of, you know, ed policy, you know, and then growth for school choice or vouchers or ESA programs? Like, what are you seeing and what's interesting you?
Yes, there's a lot of things to talk about. Obviously, on election night, everybody was looking at the map of the 50 states, and really this was focusing on federal level elections, you know, the House and the Senate for Congress, and then also governors as well, which is really important. But, you know, the obvious result of that overall level is that the Democrats took the House, and Democrats are typically less friendly to school choice. Everybody knows this, especially in most recent years. But I'm not too upset about that. I'm actually happy that there's kind of this political gridlock at the federal level, because I don't want a federal school choice program. I've been talking about this for a very long time. You know, Trump talked about, you know, reallocating a ton of federal money for a federal school choice program on his campaign trail, but he really hasn't talked about that all that much since then. So I'm kind of happy about that. And I'm glad there's a gridlock at the federal level. As far as the state level, that's where I was kind of looking at a lot of the governor's races and then just the legislatures at the in the House and the Senate at, across the 50 U.S. states. So there's some states that I'm kind of excited about, some that I'm a little less excited about. And, you know, just to go into what I was looking at on election night, so I stayed up pretty late, maybe up till 1 a.m., just refreshing the page, and looking at a few states. And in particular, I was looking at Wisconsin for a long time. As you know, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program is the longest standing voucher program, modern day voucher program in the U.S. It started in around 1990. And it's a pretty big voucher program in Wisconsin, with about 30 to 35,000 students being served each year. And it was really neck and neck all night between Scott Walker and Tony Evers. Tony Evers ended up taking the election the next day, and that's kind of a negative for the outlook of school choice in Wisconsin, the, you know, the frontier of school choice in the U.S. So I was kind of upset about that on the school choice front. But I'm not too pessimistic because at the state level, where all the magic happens, the House and the Senate are still stacked with Republicans. So although Tony Evers has vocally opposed school choice and even talked about getting rid of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program and other voucher programs in the state, I don't think that's going to happen. But at the same time, I don't think there's going to be much expansion or deregulation of the program because of the new governor there. Other locations, I was also watching Florida. So I think the recounts are finally done, from what I recall, but it looks like there's positive results in Florida. The senator is now, or the Senate election turned out to be a win for the Republicans, and the governor actually beat an incumbent Democrat. So the governor is now Republican. So I can see some expansion of school choice in Florida, hopefully in the next few coming years, or hopefully even next year. And Florida is already a rich school choice state. About 150,000 students have access to either a tax credit scholarship program or a voucher program in Florida today. So there might be some expansion there, but that's, you know, another one of the states that I really was looking at closely on election night.
So let me ask you a question, Corey, because we've lived kind of an interesting maybe decade, you know, plus with, you know, going back to, you know, the transition with No Child Left Behind, you know, a lot of ways, the charter school movement, you know, the philanthropists who poured literally billions of dollars into education. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've lived in this really interesting space since maybe about 2000, you know, give or take. And there seems to be educational fatigue, you know, educational policy fatigue, investment fatigue by philanthropists. It was an interesting time too, because some of the charter school movement and some of the, you know, the choice stuff was really pushed at the city level by, you know, whether it be, you know, independent or even Democratic mayors. And so, you know, when you look at this interesting kind of mix of libertarians and then liberals and conservatives and people that opened up a lot of these opportunities for ESA or charter schools or, you know, greater school choice programs, some of the fights in Wisconsin that you kind of reference, How does this all play out now that we kind of, you know, maybe are stepping into a little bit more of a different world and a different space where people maybe don't even have the same energy for the education reforms like they did even 5-6 years ago?
Yeah, I will say these elections, for the public at least, education was one of the bottom kind of indicators for what people were voting for. They were more, you know, interested in stuff like immigration and the overall economy. So education wasn't all that important in this election cycle. But what I'm, you know, I am pretty optimistic about the advocacy groups and, you know, stuff going on at the state level. There are pushes, you know, all across the country to try to get for universal school choice programs. So that means a voucher program or an education savings account program that would be available to everybody, regardless of your income or your background. So I think that's a step in the right direction. So, you know, although right now less than 1% of the school age population in the United States actually uses private school choice, if we can get a state to pass a universal program, that number will increase drastically. And so I think that's kind of a step in the right direction and what the states are actually pushing for. So, for example, a couple years ago, Texas and Arkansas, both highly red states, pushed for universal education savings accounts, which, if the listeners aren't familiar with those, it's like a voucher program to where if you opt out of your traditional public school, you can take those funds to the private school of your choice. The only difference is the funds now go into a savings account that you can roll over from year to year and even save for college in some locations. And also another main difference is that these savings account funds can be used for private school tuition, but can also be used for other educational services such as online learning, textbooks, and then other types of, you know, even learning therapies for special needs types of students. So those are big pushes going around. But like I said, in Texas and Arkansas, they actually failed a couple of years ago. They passed the bills in the respective House of or the Senates in each of the states, but the House of Representatives blocked them in Texas and Arkansas. And I think one of the big problems is, even though they're highly red states, is that school choice has kind of been sold as a welfare program. It's kind of been packaged as a welfare program to help the least advantaged students, to help people from poor families to get into the types of schools that rich families can already go to. And I like that message resonates with me. But in a political level, you know, you have these suburban Republican legislators that kind of see it as a welfare program, and they know their constituents already feel like they have good public schools. So, you know, it seems like a risk to them to vote for such a program. So they vote against it. So I think a better, you know, type of messaging going forward is just message it as a conservative issue and just try to get these dang things passed in states that are highly red like Texas and Arkansas, and maybe other states can see success in the states that pass these types of programs, and maybe they will follow suit in the future. But this whole messaging to the Democrats doesn't seem to be working, at least at the policy level, because these legislators that are Democrats simply are voting against school choice all across the nation. So on that note, I'm pretty optimistic about Tennessee. They're going to do a major ESA push as well. And they're a very highly red state. They have a governor that's Republican, and their House and Senate at the state level are both, I think they're, Senate outnumbers, their Republicans outnumber Democrats 5-1, and their House Republicans outnumber Democrats 3-1. So there's a good chance of that happening. I know advocacy groups such as the Beacon Center of Tennessee and American Federation for Children, their state level people over there are pushing hard for a universal ESA in Tennessee, which I think that could be the first universal ESA in the world.
I mean, this is really interesting stuff because I think people so often look at it in simplistic terms, right? But the complexity of politics, the complexity of local politics, as well as the national politics, and then where education traditionally fits in at the local level, the state level, and then, you know, kind of almost the federal level last, and how we kind of got used to since, you know, No Child Left Behind, or maybe even going back, you know, to those Bill Bennett days with the nation at risk, you know, how then the federal government took more of an interest in that. One of the things that, you know, I keep watching Chicago because that's my home city, you know, and with some of the mayoral changes there and some of the things there, Paul Vallis, who's somebody that I respect quite a bit, put out his education plan. You know, I look at Indiana because I have a lot of friends there too. But I'm in California, and it's an unusual place. And I've been watching the Janus ruling and how it's impacted, you know, unions, and how we're starting to see, you know, some of those changes and even some of the research or some of what the unions are doing with their budgets as they're cutting and shrinking down. What do you see from that side of things, you know, especially as the unions often or continuously have been the greatest inhibitor to greater school options and greater school choices?
Right. The unions are a highly political animal, and that's why Janus won the case at the Supreme Court, because he was having to support political speech that he didn't agree with. So that was a huge case. Everybody in the education and education reform communities were looking at that on the live SCOTUS blog minute by minute to try to and to try to see what the outcome was going to be and to start writing about it immediately. So that is a really stressful time, a really exciting time for education reformers across the U.S., especially reformers that are in states that are heavily blue at the moment, like California. But if you look, what's interesting to me is a recent 74 million piece, and 74 million is a national kind of news source for education and education reform issues. And they had a recent piece out that showed that since Janus, the teachers' unions lost about 84,000, or I think that's the correct number, fee payers, and they lost about 10 to 15,000 actual union members just since the Janus decision. And so what that tells me is that, you know, they lost a lot more fee payers than they did. They lost about eight times the amount of fee payers than they did actual members. So that just goes to show that there were a ton of people out there that weren't even members and that were having to pay these fees. So, you know, I see that as a huge win for just individual freedom of teachers. It also gives the unions a stronger financial incentive to actually represent their members well and to get policies passed that actually lead to higher teacher pay instead of more administrative bloat and things of that nature. But again, I do think the weakening of the unions post-Janus is a good sign for school choice reform, since, you know, education president or the teachers union presidents have for a long time just vocally been vehemently opposed to private school choice policies.
So Corey, as we finish out, you know, for today, and I appreciate your time and your energy, and I always enjoy talking with you. What do you have coming? Like, what sort of research are you doing now? Or, you know, what can you give us a snippet into to kind of, because I love following you on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I love kind of seeing the stuff that you're adding, the what you're writing on. Like, give us a sneak peek on what you're writing about or researching or thinking about as we kind of enter the end of 2018 and into 2019.
Okay, well, I'll give you three things that are either coming out soon or have recently been released. First, and this one's been gaining a lot of traction in the media. It has over 190 downloads on the Social Science Research Network, which doesn't seem like a lot, but for the academic community, that's a lot of downloads, because you're pretty much lucky if a few people read your paper at the academic level. So to have 190 downloads is a lot. But this is a paper co-authored with Angela Dills, who's a professor of economics at Western Carolina University. And this is the first paper linking private school choice and charter school choice to teen suicides and mental health in the long run, and in particular, mental health when the kids turn about 30, or when these students become about 30 years of age. And we're finding some robust evidence that charter school laws and voucher laws reduce teen suicide rates in those states. And at the individual student level, we're finding our analyses are showing that access to private schooling in general is reducing the likelihood that people are seen for mental health issues in the long run, in particular by the time they're around 30 years of age, and reducing the likelihood that they report that they are having mental health issues by around 30 years of age. So this is a huge study in particular because it's a highly sensitive subject, especially with the newly created, you know, Federal Commission on School Safety that has been going around this year trying to determine how to make public schools safer. And this is really the first study linking school choice to mental health. And, you know, there's a lot of causal links there. There could be a lot of mechanisms driving this kind of thing. You know, if you're like, you know, one of the artsy kids that are in a public school, you're typically not one of the cool kids. And that could have a negative effect on your mental health in the short and long term. So, you know, just having school choice, either a charter school or a private school that specializes in these things you're actually interested in, having that exit option could be very beneficial for mental health in the long run. So that's one of the causal links that could be explaining our findings. That's one of the papers that is already released. Here are two others that are not released yet, but one of them is looking at differences in school safety across sectors, charter, private, and public. And we're doing this in Indiana. And this is partnered with a co-author named Marty Lucan, who is an employee of EdChoice, which is formerly known as the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. But we're finding some pretty robust evidence that private schools and charter schools are safer than traditional public schools. And this goes along with a lot of the experimental evidence that shows the same thing. And I've written extensively on this on the Cato blog and at the Washington Examiner. So that should be coming in the pipeline. And then third one is Patrick Wolf from the University of Arkansas, Lindsay Burke from Heritage Foundation, and I are doing a lot of random assignment studies to see the negative effects of voucher program regulations on the amount of schools that are participating in voucher programs and the quality of schools that are participating in voucher programs. And we're doing these random assignment studies by, you know, the control group is getting a survey saying, you know, we're sending this to private school leaders in Florida, California, and New York. And we're asking them, if a new school choice program were to be enacted next year, would you participate in the program? And we give them a 1 to 5 scale, whether they're certain not to participate, to 5 being they're certain to participate. And we attach a note saying this program would not come along with any additional government red tape or regulations. And the treatment groups that we randomly assign 3 to 4 different types of regulations: standardized testing at the state level, standardized testing at the national level, random-based admissions, and requirements that say that you have to take the voucher amount as full payment. And what we're finding mostly is that these random-based admissions are just, it's a deal breaker for a lot of the private schools. They just, you know, if you take away their autonomy with random admissions and by standardized testing, they are a lot less likely, about 10 to 20 percentage points less likely to participate in these types of programs. So I think that's really important because it's actually looking at specific policy designs that we haven't been able to look at before in a rigorous way. So this is the first experiment that actually looks at these types of actual policy levers at the voucher programs.
Corey, that's amazing stuff. And I think with this podcast too, what I'll do is, especially some of the stuff that you've put out recently and some of those things that you mentioned in here with some of those people, I'll put links with the podcast and make sure that gets out. I really appreciate your time, Corey, and hope you have a great Thanksgiving, and hope you enjoy these next couple months as we head into, you know, kind of the holidays and then 2019.
Yes, you as well. It's always great talking to you. And yes, have a great Thanksgiving and happy holidays.
Thanks, Corey.